Hello, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast, episode 3. Today, we'll be talking about the Porsche Taycan beating its EPA range in two tests, and how Inside EVs will stage its own range test, the Ford Mustang Mach-E deliveries are delayed, Polestar 2 pricing is released, and much, much more. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to the Inside EVs podcast. This, for regular viewers and listeners, is episode 3. And for the eagle-eyed and eared, it would normally be Dominic doing the intro. My name is Martin Lee from the EV News Daily podcast. Dominic, you join us in the same location, but you're on your phone. We've had technical problems this morning, but we've got you, but on I would say mobile phone. You'd say cell phone, right? Are you okay?
I am okay. Hi there.
Good. Dominic Yoni, the Inside EVs editor and Inside EVs forum moderator. So we still get you on the show and we'll work out the gremlins for next week, yeah?
Yes.
Great. Okay. You can still lead us through the show as well. I just thought I'd do the first bit because we can't hear you too well. Also joined us on the podcast, as always, Tom Malogny, Inside EVs editor. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Hey, guys.
And from Out of Spec Motoring, and you've seen him on the Inside EV's YouTube channel most recently, is Kyle Connor. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, hey.
Okay, let's crack off. Dominic, you were saying the first story that you want to talk about is this Taycan, Porsche Taycan range test. Just introduce us to the story, Dominic.
Yeah, so the Taycan has seen a couple range tests this week. We had Alex Roy taking it out for a spin and getting 295 miles of range. Which is, you know, far farther than its EPA rated range. And then we just had another story this morning on Inside EVs where somebody got over 300 miles. That's again, like much farther than it's supposed to be able to go. And so what's up with that? Tom, you've had this car before. And what kind of range things, results were you getting with it?
Sure. So yeah, I've had the lucky opportunity to drive Taycan Turbo and Taycan Turbo S. Haven't driven the Taycan 4S yet, which is the vehicle that these two latest range tests were done on. And as you mentioned, one was done by Alex Roy. His estimated range came in a little bit under 300. And then the most recent one that we just posted about was Dan Edmonds, from longtime contributor to Edmonds. com, actually now is with Autoblog. He did a range test and he came up with a little more than 300 miles of range. Now, one of the things I need to qualify with is neither of these journalists drove the car the full 300 miles. Both of them stopped at about 210 or 215 miles and then added on the car's estimated range remaining to come up with their range. That's not the best way to do a real range test. If the Inside EVs readers probably saw last week, Kyle and I did the Mini Cooper SE range test where we drove the car till it wouldn't go any further. If you really want to do a proper range test, you try to control as many variables as you can and drive the car in a loop until it won't go any further. That wasn't the case with either of these Taycan range tests. But to be fair, when I had the Taycan a couple months ago and I drove it from Atlanta down to Daytona, Florida, I also stopped at a Electrify America charge station and then added on the remaining estimated miles and said, you know, we have a 240-mile range on the Turbo S. But that was out of my control. I was with a Porsche on this drive and I wasn't allowed to drive it till it stopped. But the good news is we're going to be getting a Taycan 4S soon. I don't have the exact date, but I have confirmation that Porsche is going to be giving me one. And you can bet when we get it, we're going to come up with a good course and we're going to drive it until it doesn't go any further. So while these two range tests are promising, that both drivers drove about 210 miles and still had like 30 or 40% of battery left. With what we're going to do is we're going to drive it till it doesn't go any further. We're going to try to do it under controlled circumstances. I'm probably going to do this with Kyle. And we're going to see really how far the Taycan goes on a proper range test.
So do you think these results were a little optimistic or do you think the actual range will will be in that 295, 300 miles.
So, you know, until you do it, you don't know for sure. But I have a feeling that they're pretty close to what we're going to come up with, because, you know, the when I drove the Taycan and I kept an eye on the estimated remaining miles, as long as I drove consistent, that the remaining miles were true. Now, if you drive 200 miles, you know, at 50 miles an hour, and then the last, you know, 20 or 30 miles, you've got to drive up a 6% grade and you're going to go faster. Of course, you're going to come up short of what the remaining miles are. But if the algorithm that the car calculates the remaining miles is correct, if you drive consistent over the range test, it should be fairly spot on. So my guess is that when we do a proper range test with a 4S, I think we're going to get very close to 300 miles, but we don't know till we do it. So, you know, let's see.
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with the buffer at the bottom of the battery and how the car is estimating the use of that buffer. So is that number predicting when the car hits 0% or is it 1% or 2%? For example, in the case of the Mini SE, our predicted range was very accurate once we got about halfway through the drive because it's already seen how we were going to drive. But we were still even able to push it a few miles further at the bottom just because the car is not designed really to be driven down there. They want you to plug it in before it bricks. And but we were able to get a little bit better than what it had suggested. So my prediction, if we do a 90 kilometer per hour range test in the Taycan, we'll easily get over 300 miles. If we do a 70 mile per hour, which are the two like highway versus city range tests that I like to do, I think we'll probably get in that 280, 290, but that's just the prediction. So we'll have to test it out when Tom brings it down.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the results for that, by the way. We were chatting on our group chat as we do during the week before we make the podcast. And I was saying to you guys how frustrating it was. I read an article about, I forget, either Model S or Model 3, but it was one of the very famous magazines in this country had reviewed one of the Teslas. Again, good journalists know what they're doing, not new to EVs, and they know that they can hold their own. They know what they're talking about. And yet the range they got, I think it was the Model S, the range they got was a lot less than they should have got. And so as I was reading the article and I got to the end of it, they happened to make in passing reference, they were saying, but still the car coped very well with the freezing cold conditions and the rainy weather we took it out in. And that's why I'm looking forward to an Inside EVs test, because for instance, we would mention that. So we would say, look, actually, here are some variables. And it was either a hot day, a cold day. It was raining. It was dry. The tires were properly inflated. We started with 100, exactly 100%. All those things, none of them are deal breakers, of course. But if you are going to put your name on it and say, we did a range test and this is what it does, that's why I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys do, because I know that even if you absolutely have to do something in less optimal conditions, you would explain it to the reader and you would say, actually, you know, this means this. Because for a lot of people reading a general car magazine, they wouldn't know that actually cold weather and rain, particularly really bad driving rain, can hit range pretty bad. So you need to always bear that in mind when you're reading these reviews. And it's not to say that actually what these guys who we've mentioned so far did anything bad. It's just, unless you're going to be followed around by a recovery truck, if you're working on your own and you are just driving around the streets, you don't want to drive a car around till it gets to zero and you pull over and then have to call recovery. So they're good, but I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys do.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because we're going to start testing every single EV we can get our hands on here at the facility in North Carolina. And I really want to have a consistent set of parameters that we test. Of course, we can do the standard acceleration, braking, cornering. Everyone does that. Every magazine does. That's no problem. I don't even know if it's that important. What I think is important is for Inside EV is to have like the truest range calculation for that vehicle in the given circumstance. So I'd like to pitch this question to our audience in the comments down below. what do you think is important from a range test? Do you know, things that I can think of, we want minimal wind, we want optimal weather conditions. If it's a winter test, we should make note of that and talk about if the car has a heat pump or heat scavenging or something. You know, speed, I think we'll probably do a 90 kilometer per hour and then a 70 mile per hour test. You know, these are the types of things I think we really need to sort out. And then as well as charging, I mean, I think it's important to understand the car's charging curve once we plug it in. So this will be another one. But the Mini SE, for example, has a great charging curve, small battery, relatively small range, but you can drive on trips because it charges fast till 80%. So you're getting a nice deep charge on that battery. So these are the things we need to standardize and then rank cars based off of these parameters.
Can I also ask as well, and just to jump in quickly, where do you guys stand on, because Tom, in the mini video that you made this week for the Inside EV's YouTube channel, Tom, you mentioned that the BMW i3 has the same drive modes as the Mini. They call them different things. But if you're doing a range test, do you use the most eco mode that the car provides? Because I've seen some people say, yeah, but that's not realistic. You've got to drive it like a real person and they want heating and cooling. Where do you stand on drive modes? What would you pick?
So Kyle and I did talk about this, and that's tough. It's a tough call. But what we agreed on, I believe, and what we did is what I usually do is when I'm going to do a range test, I'll put it in the range mode or green mode, but not the most extreme. Like in the case of BMW, they have four driving modes. Not all EVs do that. So we put the Mini E in the green mode, which is kind of like the range mode, but we didn't put it in the extreme green plus, because then that cuts out your HVAC system, your heating. So, you know,
You can go without cutting off HVAC.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Need to keep the creature comforts turned
exactly
on.
So, like when I drove the Taycan, when I was doing the dedicated run on the range, we put it in range mode, because I think that if people are driving a long journey and they're trying to get the most range out of the car, they'll put it in some sort of a green or range mode, but not the extreme one that cuts out all those creature comforts. So it's a good question. Under ideal circumstances, we do it in every mode and then like that figures out there. But you're talking about a whole lot of driving. And I think it's most reasonable to assume that if people in their everyday driving, when range really doesn't matter, they'll probably leave it in the default mode, whatever that is, like the normal setting. But when they're driving on very long trips, they'll probably put it in range mode, at least the smart drivers will, as long as it doesn't severely cut back all of their heating and cooling and things like that.
So in your neighborhood, Kyle, where we did the mini test, will you do that same loop? And how long is the loop? Or what are the conditions like there? Do you have a lot of hills?
Yeah, well, so the thing that I like to do is at nighttime. So we're right on I-95, which is the main highway corridor between New York, Miami, actually basically from Canada to Key West. And right. There's really little traffic here. Leaving the facility and heading south, there is some elevation, very minor, but like 1 degree slopes that go up and then back down. Something I didn't notice until Tom and I were in the Mini and we're like actually looking at the road. We're like, there is some elevation here. But once we get past about 15, 20 miles into the drive, it's pretty much dead flat from there. And there's a DC fast charging station about 15 miles south of here. So the plan usually is just to leave here full, drive past the station, down 95, loop back most of the way to that DC charger. So only 15 miles of that loop is not being driven in both directions. And I think that's, you know, especially on a Taycan that does 300 miles, it's such a small amount of driving. It probably won't make a huge difference. Because if I went to go down to Rocky Mount to go full charge a car at an Electrify America station, I mean, it could take an extra hour for it to just complete charging there. So I think we need to be somewhat reasonable with that.
That's true. That's true. And what advantage do you see driving on the highway as opposed to just like driving it around the track besides the sheer boredom?
Well, I think that the track's a good idea. I haven't done any tests, and I will do this soon. I'm curious, because our track isn't a straight oval, right? It's lefts and rights, and not really much elevation. It's only 5 feet of elevation throughout the whole track, and it's 2 miles long. But I wonder if slowing down for the corner, speeding back up for the straightaway, I think that's going to be a unrealistic testing place to get true full range of a vehicle. And that's why I like having this deserted highway right over here at nighttime. I mean, there's very little traffic and you can just kind of go slow and you don't really get in many people's way.
Or you could just go around your track at 40 and get like 600 miles out of the Taycan.
Right. Yeah. I mean, 40 miles an hour, you could just set the cruise. It would make all the corners, the increase in friction around there. I don't know how that would impact. I'll have to test it out.
Yeah. There's some sharp corners there. I don't know if that would be the best. It might be a good city cycle range test. You know, if we wanted to go that deep in the woods, you know, and do a highway test, you know, at those different speeds, and then use the track for like a city cycle. But again, you know, we could do 10 different tests with every car if we really wanted to be, you know, crazily thorough and anal about it. But I don't know if that's really necessary.
Yeah, it just comes down to, are people interested or not, right? If we do a range test on a couple of cars and no one cares, well, we won't do it. We'll just provide the content that people want to see. If everyone's like, we need to figure out the range in every scenario, well, we'll do it. But, you know, there needs to be a supply and demand thing going on here.
Well, there's been a lot of controversy in the comments of different articles this week about the Tesla's range and how it compares to the Taycan, because the Taycan is, you know, obviously the EPA range is pessimistic, and people are making the claim that the Tesla EPA range is overly optimistic. And I guess we'll get a chance to test that out when we get to Taycan, and we can maybe do it side by side down the highway with the Model S, I'm hoping. And so you both, two of you guys drive a Model 3, and some of you have had some time with the Model S as well. How do you see its real world range as compared to its EPA range?
Well, I think Tom and I can both agree it's very difficult to hit EPA rated range unless you're in great conditions. Now, I've certainly exceeded it in certain city driving scenarios, but I owned Model S, for example. And even on the 21 inch arachnid wheels that I had on my Model S, it was a performance 100 kilowatt hour car. That car would actually get closer to EPA range than my Model 3 performance gets. My Model 3 rear-wheel drive would consistently match it, but the dual-motor cars and the performance cars, same drivetrain, seem to be like a real miscalculation here as to whatever they were thinking. 300 miles is like anything close is not feasible. I think I've gotten 230 out of my car, and that's 100 to zero. So again, highway driving, but something's off with this EPA calculation. I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Yeah, I concur. I love my Model 3. I have a long-range, all-wheel drive Model 3. Absolutely love it. Wouldn't trade it for anything else right now, in that price range at least. But I agree with Kyle. It's actually the only electric vehicle that I've had, and I've owned a bunch and driven pretty much every modern electric vehicle at this point. It's really the only EV that I've driven that I can't easily match the EPA rated range, you know, without barely trying. In fact, I've never been able to achieve the 310 mile range on my car. Even driving it to really try to have long range, the best I've gotten is about 270. If I drive it normally, as I just drive my cars, I get like 220 to 230. So still love the car. I'm not bashing Tesla. But there's just something odd about the EPA range rating with those cars that, you know, I mean, they do it and then the EPA can check it, verify it. So I'm not saying that there's anything nefarious going on here, but it's just something that just doesn't seem right. It's the only car that I can't get the EPA range rating.
Well, part of the problem is the EPA range test, it's really designed for an internal combustion car, and they've just rigged it, you know, for they just make some calculations to use it for electric cars, but maybe they need their own test. Yeah, there's some inconsistencies, as you say, with the Teslas, and other brands don't have that problem, like we say the Porsche getting it, and like the Kia Niro EV does better than the Hyundai Kona Electric gets usually much better results. Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see exactly their test procedures. I believe they published them somewhere. Maybe Tom knows the source of how we can get them, but I'd like to know
we have those
what they're doing.
Yeah, they're on the EPA site. I can have it in my folder here. Yeah, fueleconomy.gov. They have some information there about it. But it'll be interesting to see what happens once we get the Taycan and
So there'll be WLTP, EPA, NEDC, and then IEV.
That's right. Well, hopefully, the idea is just to get a result that's really representative of what actual drivers see in the real world,
representative of a certain condition that the car is in one specific, like we know we'll get this on the highway and we'll know we'll get this in the city. I think it's important to have a city and highway range difference because the cars perform so differently. And the way I look at it is I'm either doing my drive exclusively in the city or exclusively on the highway. That's me, but I very rarely have this mixed driving scenario.
Yeah, and there is no one range. Like Kyle and Dominic mentioned, we can't do a range test and then people say, oh, okay, Inside EVs did the test. The car can go 274 miles. Because it's everybody's driving situation is different. All the conditions are different. But what we want to try to do is have a consistent test. So if we can manage the variables as best as we can then compare car to car. Now, you might not get the range that we get in the test, but you can see, the Taycan got, 20 miles less than the Model S. A Niro got 15 miles less. So if we can control these conditions, you can really look at the cars and compare car to car. I think that's really what we need to try to do so that we can, really give a consistent report and you can compare EV to EV. Because when you hop in that car and you drive your driving cycle, you're not going to, by luck, you'll get what we got. Everybody's driving conditions are different. So I think we just need to do the best we can to have a consistent course. And so that way you can compare EV to EV.
Right. All right. So next up, let's talk for a minute about the Ford Mustang Mach-E. Apparently production and deliveries are delayed. That's probably not a surprise to anybody. I guess when we get the news, some the Mach-E forums, some Norwegian customers got some letters to expect them, telling them to expect deliveries in about November, with production moving to June or July instead of May. Big disappointment.
As long as they can get them delivered by end of 2020, I'll be sort of happy with that.
Yeah. You don't have one on order, right?
My dad does, but I'm sure he'll let me drive it. It's a GT, but that's not coming for a little while.
Okay. That'll be nice. Martin, what do you think of the Mustang?
Yeah, this is a really promising car and something which, again, I don't think gets the same level of respect that maybe it deserves, or maybe it doesn't deserve. I think I put the Taycan in the same bracket as that because of its EPA range, and so it kind of gets dismissed, and I'm not making this a tribalism thing against the people who love Teslas and all others, but I think at the moment the Mach-E, of course, it had its fanfare launch, and it made as big a splash over here as I imagine it did there. Very excited to have that car here. And look, I'm a bit of a Ford fanboy. So I grew up in the 90s with Fast Fords on my bedroom wall on posters. That's Fast Fords have a very soft spot in my heart and my kind of buying car magazines as a teenager. So we really want to see Ford do well with the Mustang Mach-E. I would say the thing that hasn't happened here yet is there hasn't been a level of excitement growing because there is that big unknown of when it will arrive. So it's not that we're not bothered here in the UK and Europe about it, but it seems a long way off. And also the other thing as well is it's tough to get excited about a spec of car that is kind of unclear, because I don't know if this frustrates you guys as well, but I kind of come from a kind of background of, you know, I like things like the Tesla lineup, like the Apple lineup of products. There's that famous thing of when Steve Jobs came back to Apple and it was just in the toilet, and he divided the whole hundreds of products they were making, and he said, we're going to make four, and divided them into four boxes and turned the company around. And Tesla do that with their configurator. And I must say, it's one of the things that does confuse us a little bit, because what you call the Mustang Mach-E names, as it were, the spec names, Ford have done that thing that all car companies do around the world. They succumb to the regional marketing needs and the various marketing departments around the world, who each argue for their own case. And so I don't know. You say that your dad's got the GT on order. And that's the thing that confuses me about the Mustang. I'd love for them to come out and say, we've got three cars and three battery sizes. But of course, they've done that thing that all car manufacturers do, which is to go, we've got these and you can change the battery. And then there's this, and then there's the first one. But the first one's all sold out, so don't get excited about it, but be excited. And so that's our frustration. It's a case of, well, we want to get excited about it, but we don't really know what the car, we know what the car is yet. They have had one in the UK on show in London, invited people, members of the public to come down and look at it. And I must say, got a very, very good reception. So we are excited about it.
And the other thing to keep in mind here with Mach-E is, well, there's Model Y that's already out there that is in the same exact category as this car. And now Polestar 2 started production, and XC40 Recharge is not far behind, along with Kona and Niro. I would say the Mach-E is going to be definitely geared towards a better driving experience than Kona. At least I've spent a lot of time in that car. It's technically very good on paper. It's a functional vehicle, but it is like driving a washing machine. I think the Mach-E is going to be a little bit better, and it just in more fun. Just like Model Y still can get a car enthusiast excited about it, or someone who's a keen driver. But I would say the excitement level that I feel here is quite low for this vehicle. Again, big splash, kind of low right now. It deserves a lot more than it's getting, but I think we just need to wait till they start hitting the streets, and then that'll all ramp up. Tom, what do you think about this?
Yeah, well, circling back to the original question about the delay, I don't see how anybody can be, you know, concerned about that. You know, disappointed maybe, but every new car that's scheduled to launch in 2020 is going to be delayed, whether it's weeks or months. I just did an article on Byton. This was going to be their M-Byte launch at the end of the year, and now the launch is going to be, you know, they haven't really said, they haven't really used the delay word, but they're hinting that that's going to happen, and it's to be expected. But as far as the excitement, you know, Tesla just sucks all the oxygen out of the room with electric vehicles. It's almost like, you know, the only other vehicle company that I see that has really gotten people excited was Rivian, because they're making something that isn't out there, that Tesla wasn't selling, a pickup truck. So it's hard for me to really gauge, you know, the public's anticipation for the Mach-E, because Tesla just owns this EV space right now, at least here in the U.S. And that said, I've talked to Ford dealers in my area, and they're saying that people are coming down and putting deposits on these cars. So, you know, without any advertising, without much being talked about it, the original allotments are being sold out. So there's got to be, you know, there's got to be excitement that maybe we don't just feel, like, you know, you feel with Tesla. Just my Tesla's parked on the street and everybody walks by and people stop and look at it, and kids are just like, Dad, look at Tesla, you know. And there's just so much enthusiasm for the brand. I think that's going to take a while for any of the other entrenched OEMs to have their electric vehicle programs elevated to that level where there's so much excitement and people want to see them. Maybe we'll do that because people will, hopefully it's going to be a great driving vehicle.
Yeah. What can't happen is a case of like what Jaguar did with I-Pace, which is, hey, here's our electric car. Now that it's on sale, we won't do anything with it. Or we won't tell you anything about it. And by the way, we won't even send you more. My friend works at Jaguar Land Rover here, our local dealer, and they have two that they begged to get. But there's like low volume. There's none in the press fleets in the U.S. There's just one I-Pace for the entire U.S. journalism community in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's crazy. It's such a good car and they could be doing so much more with it, but they don't do anything. So I hope Ford continues this push. They've put a huge effort up front. A lot of marketing dollars were spent on this. They have good people behind the car. I got to spend some time with the chief engineer of Mach-E, about an hour. Really awesome experience. This car should be really good. I just hope that they have the marketing behind it to sort of push through all of the Tesla stuff.
I feel like just right about now is right about in this cycle where we would be getting seeing Mach-E's going out for reviews too and some test drives and just to raise its profile. So now all we have is pretty much silence and just some background controversy about them using the word Mustang for the Mach-E, which I think was a great move because it's really raised its people's awareness and given it some mind share, Tesla really dominates in that area. But there's some talk about the Mustang, obviously, since, we have dealers getting orders and, people are pretty excited about it.
Dom, I think the press drives were even before we had this, the COVID-19 shutdown and slowdown, I don't think they were going to happen till around September-ish anyway. I wasn't expecting them to be out that early. I mean, don't forget at the launch event at the LA Auto Show, we weren't able to even drive the cars. We were able to drive in them, but not drive them. And they were really early prototypes. I mean, these were, the cars had plastic panels in them that, we were told this isn't the finished product. So, they were still, 6 months minimum, 6-7 months out from being able to give them to journalists to drive. So, in best case scenario, I wasn't expecting us to do any kind of media drives till September-ish. And now, probably going to get pushed back a little bit. So, but like I said, this is all to be expected. The car's coming and hopefully they'll continue to really push it. They did a fantastic launch event. They spent a ton of money. They skimped on nothing. So, if that's any indication that they're going to put the weight of the brand behind this vehicle, it seems like they're going to do that.
Well, let's hope so. They did get some. They did have some booth space at CES as well. They had one model on the floor that people walk around and look inside, and they had one mounted on its side up on the wall, which was pretty cool to see. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. So, other news: the Polestar 2 pricing is out. This is a new brand from Volvo, an electric sub-brand, and the Polestar 2 is their second car. The first one was like a plug-in hybrid supercar. A little expensive and out of reach for most people, but the Polestar 2 is a little bit more in our range and I think comparable to the Tesla Model 3. And so the price is officially $59,900 before incentives. You got some impressions about that, Martin?
I think that Volvo / Polestar, we'll call them Polestar because they are their own thing. I just think they've got their styling so on the money at the moment. And maybe it's my personal taste. I just think the cars look fantastic. The specs are bang on the money as well. They are not going to blow anyone away. These specs aren't going to set a new level, a new definition of what an EV should be. But they're all on the money. Much like the ID3, I think, by the way, they haven't scrimped on anything. They're going to hit all of the targets that their buyers are going to want. But just look at it. I just think it looks stunning. And if you are not at the moment blown away by any of the EVs on the market, I genuinely think that the Polestar range, but the Polestar 2 is going to be a car that I think people should look at. And the specs, the internals, if you're not an engineering kind of person, they're all covered off. They're all going to be fine. The inside looks, it's not the anti-Tesla, but it's certainly not the single screen minimalism thing going on. You know, inside you feel like you're sitting inside a almost like a jet cockpit. Really well designed inside and out as well. The nice little touches have been thought of too, and I really wish them the best for this. I just think it's a beautiful looking EV.
Yeah, I agree. I've got to see it in person. I am a huge fan of everything Volvo is doing for their design language for their cars. I think Polestar carries that same. I mean, if you took the Polestar badge off, everyone would think it's a Volvo anyway. It looks amazing. It feels really great. The material qualities are nice. And similar to Volvo's sort of ethos, the Polestar thing, everything's just nice. You get in there, it's where it should be. It's not overly impressive. It's not designed to, you know, set your hair on fire with performance numbers. It's just the nicest way to get from A to B. And it's that sort of Swedish. It is minimalist, but not like the Model 3. It's really, as Martin said, bang on the money. It's perfect. I really actually wanted to get one of these. However, the rear slopes a little bit too far down in the back for my big dogs, so they wouldn't really be able to fit. So I think the XC40 Recharge, which is the same internals, same hardware, has a little bit larger trunk space, which will accommodate the pups along for the ride a little bit better than this. But I'm a huge fan of this car.
And that, so the XC40 Recharge, that's the full EV from there's a first full EV from Volvo, and you get that where you are as well?
Yes, we'll be getting it. It's the exact same drivetrain as Polestar 2.
So they're both built on the CMA platform, compact modular architecture?
I actually think they're using the standard, probably an adapted version of the, I think it's SPA, Scalable Product Architecture, for the XC40.
Just remind me, I was at the XC40 Recharge launch, but I don't remember, but I have the specs for the Polestar 2 in front of me. So do you know offhand if the XC40 Recharge has the 78 kilowatt hour battery?
Yeah, it's somewhere around there, 74, 78 kilowatt hour, something like that. Okay. Same power output.
Yeah. The range is slightly off. I think it's probably just an aerodynamics thing. Yeah, but it's a bigger,
can't be that
heavier car.
Yeah.
So while I was at the XC40 Recharge launch, I got to ride in a number of Volvo products. Man, I have the last Volvo I was in was like an old wagon from the 80s, which, you know, is great. But these things are world class, and I really like, and the sound system, the stereo,
ours was
in the back seat. I was so blown away.
It is worth every penny. They're so good. My friend just got the V90 R design T5. It's not a plug-in or electric, and oh, it's so great. And I'm supposed to get the new V60 plug-in hybrid Polestar engineered very soon to test, which I'll do some stuff with Inside EVs on. It is one of the few applications where plug-in hybrids are used to enhance performance, not just efficiency. So that gets me excited.
So Tom, so the price for this is $59,100. How does that come? And that's before incentives. So with incentives, it's going to be cheaper. Tesla has already gone through all its, government rebates, $7,500 rebates. So how do you think this compares to a Tesla Model 3 now?
Well, so yeah, while it starts at just a tick under 60, I think most buyers are going to get a couple of the boxes that there's some important options that you're going to want, that it's probably going to still be around 70,000. So that it's still going to be a great leap higher than a Model 3. I mean, it will probably be this. It'll cost more than a Model 3 performance if it's comparably equipped. So I think in that regards, it's going to be a tough sell. Now, I like the Polestar 2. Don't get me wrong. I got to sit in one on a couple occasions, and it's beautiful. One of the things I didn't like as much as, say, Martin did. Martin talked about the cockpit-style interior. I think the layout is beautiful, but I also felt a little cramped in there. The center console is very high, And one of the things I really like about EVs with the flat floors and no transmission tunnel, you don't have to have this big center console that kind of divides the two front seating areas. And it gives a feeling of openness in electric vehicles. Whereas with the Polestar 2, I felt like I was going back to a 1980s car where I was like sitting in a cockpit. And while it looked beautiful, the layout was nice, I couldn't help but feel like, is this the right direction to be going in? It felt like a step backwards to me in that regard. I also think that it's going to be a tough sell here in the U.S. I don't think it's going to do well here at all, personally. I don't think that it's its own fault, because I think it's a great EV. I just think that the fact that most people that are going to be buying this, or potential buyers, will be their first electric vehicle. And they're already going to be concerned about electric vehicles. So I think they're going to try to go with a brand that they trust. And who trusts Polestar? You know, nobody has even heard of Polestar. It's possible that they'll trust the Volvo name because it's a Volvo brand. I just think the whole combination of that is going to lead to this being an absolute dud in the U.S. I don't think it's going to sell here at all. I think it's a shame because it's a really nice EV. But I think the pricing compared to Tesla right now, for most people, is the gold standard. You're going to have cars like the Mustang Mach-E coming out. They're going to be selling for $25,000 less from a trusted brand. All that's going to conspire to, you're going to talk, dozens of Polestar 2 sales per month, not thousands or even hundreds, but let's say.
Man, I'm hoping for at least 100, but man, dozens. So that'd be heartbreaking.
Let's see.
All right. So what else in the news? We have, let's jump back to Ford for a moment. They released yesterday, or revealed, the Ford Mustang Cobra Jet 1400 drag race machine, which is built basically on the bones of a Cobra Jet series of cars that they make. I think this year they're making like 68 of them, I believe we said, on Inside EVs. So it's a very low volume sort of specialty drag racing vehicle. And this electric version is a one-off. Martin, have you read about this?
Yeah. And you know what? It's great, because there are certain people that won't believe that EVs are better until they see it with their own eyes. And you know what? That's fine. And we don't need to convert everybody. This isn't a cult. And there will be people that just need to see it, and they need to see how great EVs are, because they'll go to the drag strip. And I know there's the whole kind of sub YouTube community of doing testers on drag strips and Brooks at drag times. However, these kind of projects are fantastic for getting headlines, and they do change people's opinions, and they're great as an example to show off technology. You know, it does make the headlines. We all got excited when we saw this yesterday, whenever it was, a couple of days ago, and we see the video. It just looks cool, and it's great. They probably put, I don't know, 10 people, maybe 10 engineers, and what do you reckon, $1 million or something, and said, you know, you go away and you do that. However, as cool as this is, should we be applauding car companies for doing stunts like this? Or should we get more excited when they put 100,000 people and 100, you know, or $1 billion behind the development of a mainstream car that is actually useful? I mean, how good are these vanity projects? I'm looking at you, VW IDR, going up Pike's Peak. I mean, how much use is that? How much of that technology can transfer to the road cars? Does it just get headlines? Is there any point doing things like this? I think it's cool to see. And then I kind of wonder, you know, could they have spent that money on something else maybe?
Right. Well, this one's kind of interesting. It's 1400 horsepower, hence the name. And they're suggesting it will get low into the eights and a quarter mile, but it's the same team. And we look under the hood, and it's got, actually, you can see the components are from Cascadia Motion, which is the same supplier and the same components used by the same sort of the suppliers and the engineers who made the Camaro eCopo drag car from a year or two ago. There, you can see it now. Yeah. So you got the motor in the middle. Actually, that's two motors, two double stack motors. So there's actually four motors going on in that thing. And I suspect they're kind of hooked together at the, on the back end, maybe with a chain. And those four are four things on the sides are inverters. On the Inside EVs forum, actually, we have I have these labeled out exactly what they are. I asked some questions on a Facebook group, and actually Mate Rimac told me that the about the inverters and what brand they are, and the engineer who behind the the whole setup chimed in and named off some of the other things. It uses actually the same T400 transmission that's in the regular Cobra Jet. So what do you think about this here, Kyle?
Well, first off, I don't think I want to discourage anyone from doing cool things with electric cars. I think that's awesome, right? That's pretty cool. It's a cool halo piece. Personally, I just think this will never benefit an end user of this particular product. Look, it's really cool. They went fast. They got headlines. Typically, these projects are to excite the internal engineering team to get them, you know, pumped up about a project. Like, let's go make a, XC40 Recharge or Polestar 2 rally car, right? That would get their team excited. They're not just building, you know, appliances, washing machines to drive. You know, you're doing something amazing. But this was all sourced from a third-party company. So I wonder how many Ford engineers really got the pleasure to work on this project. And is this purely just a headline grabber? It will go get parked into a warehouse somewhere and never to be seen again. I hope that's not the case. I hope they do cool things with it. I hope they win races and do show the world. But until we see exactly their use case for this car, I can't be fully supportive, but it doesn't hurt anything. Like, great, go do cool stuff. I'm all about it.
Yeah, thoughts on this, Tom?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of a hybrid response to Martin and Kyle's. For two reasons, I'm supportive of this. Number one, it's just good to see a different type of EV out there. One of the things that we need to see is electric vehicles in all different sizes, shapes, and forms. So, yeah, we need to see the manufacturers making these extreme drag strip cars, just like we need to see them doing experimental cars that, you know, are super lightweight, extremely efficient with solar panels on the roof. You know, all that R&D does get baked back into the production vehicles. I've had a lot of discussions with product engineers over the years and, you know, even kind of asked direct questions about why are you even making this car? It seems like it's just a money sink and you're never going to come anything out of it. And, you know, they all respond to me like, look, believe it or not, we learn a lot from these extreme cars we make, just like the manufacturers learn a lot from their Formula E cars right now. They learn a lot about, you know, power electronics, cooling, motor cooling, and that stuff does get brought over and makes their production vehicles better. Now, this might be a little different, as Kyle mentioned. A lot of the parts were third-party sourced. So I don't know, but I definitely I'm happy to see it. I think that I'd rather see them doing this than building some, you know, 1,000 horsepower gas Mustang that, you know, they're not going to really learn as much as maybe they will with the electric powertrain, which they're still, you know, at the very beginning of understanding how to, you know, increase efficiencies on the batteries and all the modules in the electric cars, you know, with their gas engines. They've been tweaking them and perfecting them for 100 years. So I think there's more to learn about the electric powertrain. So I'm fine with them doing this stuff. And, you know, it's great to see them put this thing on the quarter mile and run an 8-second quarter mile. I think it'll open eyes of a lot of people that maybe weren't interested in electric cars before. So go for it. I mean, I don't see a downside on it. So I'm happy they're doing it.
Yeah, I like that. If it generates excitement, I think it's great. I just would have liked to see, say, Mustang Mach-E parts used and the Ford engineering team. Maybe the Ford engineering team can get some benefit you know, but looking over this and see, you know, how these people who specialize, they've built a number of, you know, electric racing cars over the time, and see how they do it, and maybe they can learn something through that way, which is, yeah. But anyway, moving on, let's just hit Rivian real quickly. They put out a video last week, and an interesting little update of what's going on with them. So they're shut down, their production, they can't do anything at the moment, but they're still working. They're still working remotely. They had this little gift. They have one of their test trucks prototypes in a shop in North Carolina, you know, on the machine, getting all its suspension tested. But at the same time, it's being run by a guy, being controlled by an engineer in like Irvine, California, like 3,000 miles away. So that was kind of nice to see. That's in your neck of the woods too, Kyle.
Yeah, not far from here. I guess you tried to shoot them an email. I don't know if they got back to you. We'd really like to get the Rivian here for some testing. I think that'd be kind of fun to do something while it's at least in the area. I'm a big fan of everything Rivian's putting out. Between this story and their recent one about how they're designing their interiors and the use case of the vehicle, it's actually cool to see that they sent their employees and their designers to go skiing, hiking, skateboarding, whatever the task was, and then to make the vehicle better and talk to other people in parking lots of ski resorts. What don't you like about your car when you go skiing? Okay, we'll put this rubber strip on the back so it doesn't fall down. I think they're really taking a holistic approach to building a car, something totally different that we really haven't seen since Tesla. And that's why people are excited about it. That's why I'm excited about it. And it's really important that they get their suspension tuning right and everything like this. So they got it on jigs. And that's for the car to drive right. That's the last step to make this a winning vehicle.
I don't want to spend too much time on this because we got to want to hit a couple other things real quick. But it's exciting to see the Rivian project still going. And you know, it'll be here first part of next year, I believe. So Hyundai, last year they showed us a concept called the 45 concept. And more recently, they were supposed to show us something called the Prophecy. That show got canceled because of the situation. But apparently they've both got the green light to go into production. It's kind of bizarre. Have you seen this, Martin?
Yeah, I kind of, it's very, very curious to look at these concept cars. And admittedly, this is, take a look at that, is never going to make its way on the road. But I love to see things like this because they're an idea of where car companies are going. It's an idea of what's in their mind, their style, and going from, and look at that. It just looks so kind of cool and interesting. And where's the doors? There's the doors. Yeah. I mean, it's great. And I love stuff like this because it's an idea of where they're going, but will we be driving one of these? I'm not so sure about that. What do you think?
I believe they said this might replace the Ioniq. So it looks like a sports car here, but I'm not sure if that's exactly what they have intended for. And it won't have those suicide doors either.
That'll be a big upgrade from an Ioniq right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautiful, that teardrop shape and smooth, but it's so different stylistically than the other car, the 45, which is like a small, I would say like a compact crossover with the really high door sills. It's kind of a smallish greenhouse and a lot of like origami almost. Creases and lines everywhere. Have you seen that, Tom?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I'm going to throw some cold water on it. Yeah, it looks great. It's exciting and everything, but enough with the concepts. You know, I almost think, you know, the automotive industry should evolve from that. You know, for decades, the car companies came out with these wild concepts and, you know, 90% of them never made it to production. And I get that they learn some things from them and they can transfer that over, but it's kind of like, don't tease us if this isn't going to come, you know, and if you think that it might, then say that. But what I love is some of these new startups like Tesla, Rivian, What they're doing is they're coming out with a car and saying, look, you'll be able to drive this car in 2 years. And I think that's really what we need to start to move towards, rather than these, you know, endless lists of concept cars. I mean, Audi was great for that for years with their EVs, and they showed us so many different cars. BMW, to some extent now, it's like, you know, how long are we going to see concept i4 and, you know, the iNext? And we just keep seeing these endless lists of concept cars. I remember the i3 was the mega city car. Yeah, it finally came, but like they paraded that thing around for 4 years until, you know, in all different iterations of it. They showed it in a two-door coupe, and it's kind of like, all right, show us what you're going to deliver, please. And the other stuff, there should be like a big label on it, a big sticker that says, you know, not for sale. You know, maybe I'm a little jaded with it, but I've just seen so many EV concepts over the last 5 or 6 years. So few of them we ever actually get a chance to drive. So I have high hopes for Hyundai and Kia as far as the EV programs. But I'm not too excited about this because I don't think we're going to see it.
Do you like these cars, Kyle?
Not really. They've never done anything for me, to be honest. I just think it's a waste of time.
The concepts in general, or these concepts?
No, just concept cars in general. Like Tom said, I think the i3 and the i8 concepts were the only ones to ever really look like the concepts, and it came 4 years after. And yeah, I think it's a great way to show what your company's doing, you know, in the future, but you still need to sell cars today. So make those look good, get those products on the road. I don't really care what you're going to do in 5 years unless I can drive it. This is just me. And yeah, so not my thing.
Right. I tend to like the concepts a bit, but I think maybe companies spend a lot more money on them than they really need to. Like, I keep thinking of the Aria, you know, they had a concept, was it the IMX or something like that? A lot of little straight edges. But then they brought out the Aria, which was supposed to be, you know, derived from that concept. And there's not a whole lot of resemblance going on. I love the Aria. It looks great. And that's another electric crossover that's high on the list of things to get excited about. But yeah, it didn't look anything like the original concept. And I believe the Aria will actually get some changes because that's actually a concept as well. But it'll be very close to what the production vehicle will look like. And I'm kind of hoping to keep that same name as well. I think we should probably wrap things up. We've been going on for a little while now. And again, sorry about the technical difficulties. We'll have things straightened up next week. And so you can catch me on Inside EVs and the Inside EVs forum. And Martin Lee, you're on EV News Daily podcast every day on YouTube and all your premium podcast platforms. Kyle, you're on YouTube at Respect Motoring.
Yeah, and you're on channel One Lap, youtube.com/OneLap. It's one lap of the track in any vehicle.
And you've already got a couple of videos up on that?
Yeah, I did the Mini SE, Tesla Model X. I have a whole bunch banked up from silly stuff to school buses. So yeah, you'll see some wild things.
Yeah, definitely search One Lap on YouTube. That's going to be a great channel. I really love this concept. And Tom Longney, you can find him on Inside EVs and on the Inside EVs podcast. And that's great. Well, we'll see you guys next week.